All right. So where did you grow up, Al?
Well, my folks, when I was born, they lived in Yakima, Washington, and they moved very shortly to the Ontario area. Literally, when I was 12 days old, they took a ferry across the Columbia River during the Vanport flood. My mother always talks about that. There she was with a 12-day-old baby, sandwiched in a car going across the Columbia in this huge flood
Oh my gosh.
on a car ferry. And she couldn't have gotten out. There was no way she could have dealt with it if the thing capsized or something, but it didn't. So on we went. They lived in Ontario until I was about 3 years old. Then they moved to Stibnite, Idaho, which is a town above. You may have heard of McCall, Idaho. Stibnite is a little town about 8,500 feet. It was what was it? Manganese mine. No, a tungsten mine. My dad worked as a mechanic in the smelter. Then they moved, after they were there for about a year and a half, they moved to Henderson, Nevada. Big change. Climate-wise, Henderson is a town about I think 30 miles south of Nevada, or 30 miles south of Las Vegas, might be north. I can't remember. Anyway, at that time, right now it's all built up. You can't tell when you leave Las Vegas and get to Henderson, but at that time there was 30 miles of desert in between the two places. But they lived there until I was five and a half years old, somewhere in there, and then they moved to Riddle, Oregon.
Do you remember moving around? I mean, you were pretty young at that time, so you probably don't remember most of those first moves.
I have like a recollection of Stibnite, Idaho. The snow was so deep that it was all the way up to the rafters of this little company house that they lived in, and so it was way over my head, and I remember walking out with our dog, and the snow was way up there. Henderson, I remember a few more things. Kids riding me on the handlebars of their bike to go on a movie on Saturday afternoon, that sort of thing. But Riddle's where I really grew up from 5 years on, five and a half on. I lived in Riddle, and I went through first grade through graduating from high school in Riddle.
And do you have any siblings?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any siblings?
No. My folks had a little girl before me who lived about 6 weeks. They had an RH factor problem with the blood between my mom and dad. Their RH factors were incompatible, and so the baby's blood didn't. It kind of reacted to its own blood. It was a thing that just a couple of years later they could fix very easily at birth, but it hadn't happened yet. My mom was an RN, and that was very difficult for them. The baby couldn't eat,
Oh my
couldn't hold
gosh.
down any food. It was just 6 weeks of hell, I think, and then
Yeah, I
eventually
can't imagine.
died. But anyway, then
So, but I mean, you grew up in essence as an only child then.
absolutely, I grew up as an only child. I did.
Did you have a good relationship with your parents? Were you close with them?
I'm sorry, say
Did
again.
you have a good relationship with your parents? Were you close with them?
I did. My dad and I were kind of like oil and water, and that got worse and worse as I got older. Well, this is, I don't, he also suffered. I suffered from depression. He also suffered from depression, only the poor guy, he didn't, I mean, nobody did anything about it.
Right.
And if you went to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, you were crazy and you got branded as crazy, and he didn't do that. And so, as I got older, we got along less and less. But basically, I certainly wasn't abused. Had a pretty good childhood. One of the things I've told my kids always, and some paid attention, some didn't, is don't have an only child. It's just looking back on it, it's more difficult for an only child to adapt socially. You just don't have that interaction between your siblings.
Yeah.
Need before you get out there and start interacting with a whole bunch of other people. But you know, that just is what it is. And sometimes you end up with only children and they survive. And I had a good childhood.
I remember because we had Gabe and I was having serious stomach issues. I had had major surgery. And yeah. I remember having a discussion with Angie and saying, you know, do we want to have another one? Like maybe one is enough. And we both decided, we're like, no, I don't want to have an only child. And yeah, for a lot of the same reasons that you said, because I have a close friend who's an only child and we had been around a couple other families that had only children. And yeah, the only children, well, number one, it's more work because your kid doesn't have anybody to play with. So they're always playing with mom and dad, which takes more time. And then B, it's like you said, I think they're just socially, they're a little more awkward just because they don't have that sibling growing up with them. So I remember having a discussion with my wife and saying, whatever we're going to do, we got to have at least two because we didn't want to have an only child. So it's interesting to hear you say the same thing from your point of view, because that was always my experience from the outside looking in.
You know, we lived a couple of miles out in the country from Riddle, which was a town of 1,000 people on its good days. And so I didn't, there were neighbor kids, but not super close by. And I played by myself an awful lot. Now, for a little boy who likes to be outdoors and do things outdoors, I mean, we lived on a 20-acre place that butted up to some orchards on one side and some National Forest or BLM land on the other side. I mean, I could cross the back fence to our place and keep going for 50 miles if I wanted to. And as I grew older, I did a lot of tramping around out there. Sometimes I would have friends out from town, and sometimes I did it by myself. My folks did not play with me or feel they should be entertaining me. That just, they were both raised in large families, and they were farm kids. That was their background. They were both from farm families. My dad was a farmer until he decided to switch and be a mechanic, but it just didn't occur to them. Kids just went off and played. That's what you did.
Right.
Or you worked. You had work to do. My folks didn't make me do a lot of work, but they didn't spend a lot of time entertaining me either.
What was your high school experience like?
Sometimes my mom would take me to visit other kids. More often than not, I just walked the 2 miles into town.
Yeah. What was your high school experience like? What did you do in high school? Did you play sports? Or?
I did play sports. Real high school was a tiny little high school. There was only 200 kids in the whole high school. So you knew everybody, and you either knew their big brothers or their little brothers or whatever, knew their families to a large degree. There were 40 kids in my graduating class, 42 maybe. I did play. Yeah. If you were my size in a little school in a little logging town, you played football.
Yeah.
And so I played football. I got the hell beat out of me my first year playing football, and to the point where my dad even said, if you want to quit, you can quit. And I was just covered with bruises. I bruised real easily. I was kind of a soft, pudgy kid. But I stuck it out. And it was very, very good for me. And it gave me a much greater place in my social community, being a football player. And I also wrestled all 4 years, as well as played football. And I lettered the last 3 years in both those sports. And they were they were so good for me. That was really good for me. But the other thing you have to understand about a little tiny school like that is you can be everything. So I was, I ran around with the hoodie kids. I ran around with the athletes. I ran around with the scholars. I didn't get great grades in high school. I got like straight A's all through grade school and then kind of lost interest in it. So I lived off test scores. I was a good test taker and I always got, you know, achievement test scores. I scored in the 12th grade when I was in the 7th grade. But as far as getting, you know, buckling down and getting the grades, I think I came out of high school with just a little bit above a C average. But I took the SAT, scored very, very well on it. And so I got into college, no problem. Actually got a scholarship.
Wow.
To go to college.
And where did you go to college?
Oregon State.
Okay.
And like what the only place to go.
What's your degree in?
Business.
So right out of high school, you go to Oregon State. Did you know what you wanted to do?
Absolutely not. You know, my folks, I was always going to college. There was just no question about it. My dad worked his way up from being a farmer. He went to one semester of college, but it was during the Depression, and his dad was having a little trouble at home, and he just had to come go to work. He couldn't afford. He was basically supporting himself at that point, and his dad couldn't help him out, so he didn't have any choice. But and he worked his way up from being a farmer to because he was a farmer, he fixed everything they had, so he was kind of a self-taught mechanic. And then he got a job as a mechanic in one of the canneries there in the Ontario Payette area, right on the Oregon-Idaho border. And through that job, he got a job as a mechanic in that smelter in Stibnite, got a job as a master mechanic in the smelter in Henderson, and was the first foreman they hired at the nickel smelter in Riddle. And there was a bunch of guys that he worked with at those previous two smelters that kind of took care of each other and moved from place to place more or less together. And so it was like, hey, Clark, come on up here. I just got the job as general foreman, and I want you to come be a foreman under me. And so he did. So that's the way it worked out. But because of that, he always said, you're going to college. Nothing's going to hold you back. He ended up being general foreman of that smelter for the last several years I lived there. They had a thing at the general, as being general foreman, you trained the superintendent as assistant general foreman underneath you with the understanding he was going to get promoted above you because that was the guy with a college degree in metallurgy or whatever. And to his credit, he trained five or six of them. And then they would go on back to the headquarters in back east. And another one would come in. And finally, he got one came in. And while he was underneath my dad told him, he said, this guy's just a son of a bitch, and I'm not going to work for him. So when you get ready to promote him as superintendent over me, I'll quit. And they said, oh, Clark, you won't do that. Come on now. He did it. By that time, I was a freshman in college. I was working, making most of my own money, going to school. And he and my cousin bought big over-the-road tractor trailers and started a small trucking business. And he told him to stick it.
So you think he was adamant about you going to college because just he was a blue-collar worker his whole life and he didn't want that life for you?
Because he was what? I'm sorry.
Because he was a blue collar worker. Cause I mean, he wanted you to have a different lifestyle than he had.
Yeah, I think so to some degree. That's true. Yeah. He wanted me to have a different life than he had. Actually, if I'd had my druthers, looking back on it, I would have been happy being a farmer. And to answer your earlier question, was I all ready to go to college with my life all stacked up in front of me with a plan? Absolutely not. As I said, I got a scholarship with a consortium of trucking companies that were offering a transportation scholarship, which I also hadn't remotely considered being a possibility until the guidance counselor said, "Al, there's a scholarship here, and I think you can get it." And I did. It was a full, they didn't pay living expenses, but they paid all tuition, books, all that stuff.
Wow.
They paid for my first year of college. I went to work for that trucking company, for one of those trucking companies in Spokane the summer after my first year in college. And when I got back to school, I found out that the college and the trucking company had gotten in a pissing contest and dropped a scholarship. So yeah. I was SOL.
You seem like a pretty dedicated, hardworking guy. Do you think you learned your work ethic from your dad?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my dad and my mom. My mom was an RN.
Oh, that's true.
A farm kid who put herself through nurse's training after she graduated from high school. And I mean, that was a fantastic achievement. She bought her parents their first car after she graduated.
Oh, wow.
As an RN. That's the kind of her family, more so than my dad's family, but both of them were poor farmers. They weren't destitute. They always had plenty to eat, but they didn't have much money at all. My dad wired his parents' house when electricity first came out there.
Wow.
And I said, "Well, how'd you know how to do that?" And he said, some guy told me the basics of it, and we just did it. We just figured it out as we went, and it didn't burn the house down, so I guess we did it right.
Huh, that's
and
cool.
That's the way I learned to, George is kind of the Mr. Fix-It, and I know when he told you how he approached things, he was always curious, tore things apart, put them back together. I am also kind of a Mr. Fix-It, but I had a different approach. I was raised with a farmer's attitude that if it's yours and you want to use it and it broke, then my dad would say, "Hey, somebody built it. You're probably as smart as they are. Go figure out how it works and put it back together." And we did that. We fixed things. He wired his own house. He built a good part of his own house when I was a kid growing up. And he taught me to do that stuff. We had a pump. So if the pump went out in the well, we fixed it. I don't ever recall a repairman coming to our house.
Yeah.
But I didn't have George's, if it wasn't broke, I didn't fix it. I mean, I'm the original one of those guys.
Right.
If it was broke, then I went and figured out how it worked and I made it work.
You're not taking things apart just for the sake of taking them apart.
Right. I didn't have his insatiable mechanical curiosity. I had quite a bit of mechanical ability, and if something broke in our household throughout Julie and I's married life, I usually at least had the first go at fixing it. Most of the time I could do it. Sometimes I couldn't, and I
had
somebody come in and do it, but most of the time I did it. But it was just a cultural thing that I got raised with. It's still hard for me today. I mean, there's a lot of jobs I just shouldn't take on, but my gut reaction is when something breaks, I should fix it.
Yeah, sure. So you graduated college with a business degree.
Did
you know what you wanted to do next?
From transportation to business. And, I'm a terrible student. I don't like school. And I don't, I just got by. I was famous for going to the first class, getting the book, finding out when the midterm was, reading the part that I needed to do for the midterm the night before, passing the test, and doing the same thing with the final exam. It's, you don't learn a hell of a lot doing that. I would forget it the day after I took the test.
Sure.
But that's the way I got through college.
So what did you do with your degree after college?
Well, there wasn't a hell of a lot. When I graduated in 1970, we were kind of in a minor recession. There weren't a lot of jobs to be had out there. And for somebody with a degree in general business and a 2.3 or something GPA, I don't know what it was, but it didn't amount to much. I literally, my last semester, I had to have all the credits I was signed up for in order to graduate. I had absolutely the minimum number of credits. And I went to the final for a archaeology class. Well, there was nobody in the room. It was a big amphitheater class that I'd just thrown into my schedule to get the hours I needed. It turned out that the guy had said, asked the class if they didn't want to take the final during dead week because he wanted to get it over with. So the final was over. I went to his office, or I went to the dean's office, I guess, found out where his office was. And he said, well, it's tough. You fail. You didn't take the final. You fail. And I said, if I fail, I'm not going to graduate. He said, you should have thought of that earlier. I don't like people who don't come to my class. And I fortunately had the wherewithal to think, well, you know, as I recall, it's absolutely against the rules for you to go final during dead week, whether the students agree to it or not. And he said, well, they all agreed. And I said, no, that's not what the rules say. The rules say you can't give any exams during dead week. It's dead week. Everybody's supposed to be studying. They're not supposed to have to take any tests during dead week. Okay, I'll give you the test now. And he gave me the test, and he said, I'm only giving you a D. I got all the answers right on the test. He wrote a D on it and passed me, and I graduated.
So you got him on a technicality.
I did. Well, so I had no place. Jobs were not available. I took the LSAT, which is the law school SAT, and I did very well on it. You know, once again, I got a very high test score. So even with a crappy GPA, I got into Lewis and Clark Law School and started going to law school. Just once again, I had no burning. It was just one of the tests that was out there to take that I did well on. It was, it was a hard test. It was a half a day or a full day writing essays and doing stuff. But I got a good enough score on it that I got into law school, and so I went to law school.
I had no idea. I think it was Julie that mentioned that you had a law background, and I mean, I don't know how long I've known you now, but I don't think I ever knew that. I don't think it's come up before. So talk about that a little bit. So So what did you do in law school?
I went to law school. I went to Day Law School for the first year. Julie had a job. That's when she was working for the Kaiser Foundation Research Center in Portland. So she was supporting us. We had a little house on the top of Palatine Hill, kind of this idyllic little knotty pine cabin right up in the middle of, right next to Lewis and Clark College. And I went to law school. I didn't like it, but it was something to do.
Did you want to be a lawyer?
I started my second year in law school, and I just was miserable. I told Julie, this is enough of this crap. I can't stand having you support us and me not doing anything towards my share of our life. And so I'm going to drop out. That's what I initially was going to do. But we talked it over, and I talked to the law school a little bit, and they said, why don't you just withdraw in good standing? We'll let you do that. So before I took finals for my first semester of my second year, I withdrew in good standing. And I got a job, actually, I ended up getting a job working for Fuller O'Brien Paint Company. They had a warehouse in Portland. And they had me, hired me as a management trainee, but really I was just a glorified warehouseman. I did stock work in a warehouse. But at the same time, I had taken a civil service exam. So about the time I decided, you know, this warehouse thing is just bullshit. They don't have any intention of me being a manager. I'm just cheap help that they don't have to pay union wages to. I got a thing from IRS saying, come in for an interview. So I did. I got a job with IRS in the office audit section, which did the audits of individual taxpayers rather than business audits. I started doing that. I was doing okay. I decided I would go back to law school at night. So I did. So I worked for IRS during the day, went back to law school at night, ended up transferring over to the taxpayer service section, which helped people with their tax problems during the filing season as well as the rest of the time. And actually was doing, I did pretty well there. I made a couple of grade increases. And by the time I graduated from law school, I was making, I don't know, $13,000-$14,000 a year, which a law school graduate, I also took the bar. I had decided I really didn't like law. I didn't want to practice law. The kids that were graduating from law school were going to work at law firms making $5,000 or $6,000 a year. I was already making $11,000, and I sure as hell was not going to take a half cut in pay. We'd bought our first house already by that time. We'd had Julie the summer after I graduated, Julie got pregnant. So my wife was pregnant with our first child. I just wasn't about to take a big cut in pay, but I did take the bar review, took the bar exam, passed the bar, so I didn't have to go through life saying I went to law school, but I didn't pass the bar. So I was a duly accredited member of the Oregon Bar. We had Sarah, was born in October. I passed the bar, I think, in September. Sarah was born in October. And I'm still working for taxpayer service. I've got a pretty good job with them, but it's not a career-level position where you would stay for the... I mean, it was for some people, but it wasn't where I wanted to stay for the rest of my life. And the Office of Criminal Investigation had an interview. And my supervisor where I was working said, you know, you ought to go take this interview. I'll set it up. They'll interview you if you want. It's a really tough interview and it'll be good practice for you. Well, I went up and took the interview. It was about 3 hours long. There were scenarios they put you in and everything. Well, about halfway through this interview, I decided, God, this is a really neat job. And what you have to understand is that I was pretty much living like a monk. I mean, I was working during the day, going to law school at night. I had, you know, Julie and I were living together. We were fine, but we had no, there was no outside life. That was just life. That was it. I went to law school till 11 o'clock or so every night. I came home, studied for a while, went to sleep with a cup of coffee in my hand, woke up, went to work. Lived off coffee again. I just, it was that kind of life.
Just hectic. Yeah.
So about halfway through this interview, I said, Jesus, this is really a neat job. I mean, these guys have cars. They have guns. They're pretty much on their own. They do all these neat things. And I was not used to the scholastic life. So I was just about ready to go berserk. And this job just sounded like heaven to me. And lo and behold, I sounded okay to them, so I got the job.
And you worked for them for quite a while, right?
Pardon?
you worked for them for quite a while, right?
Well, that was basically my career. I kept working for them. I didn't, it turned out, I started working for them. It was a big adjustment for Julie to go through, because all of a sudden I was out, instead of coming home at 11 o'clock at night, I was coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning. I started out before I ever even went to training. I had to go to training in Glencoe before I even did that. They were working a big operation on massage parlors that weren't paying taxes.
Oh, interesting.
And so there was all kinds of nighttime surveillance and
oh, sure.
Nighttime arrests and that kind of thing. Well, they were short of guys and they liked me okay. I mean, I was just kind of around the office. Until you go to training, you're not supposed to get to carry a weapon or do all that stuff. The chief was an old Cajun guy, Bernie Weiss. I loved him. He called me in and said, well, what's your background? I said, well, I was raised in a little logging town. He said, well, you've been around firearms. I said, oh, yeah, all my life. And he said, okay, give him a gun, take him down, qualify him, and we're going to put you out on the street. So he got me a badge. He got me a gun before I had ever gone to any of the training. I was out on the street in a car doing surveillance. Surveillances would usually get over at 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd go find a bar someplace that had
right.
And, we'd let the guy close the bar, but we stayed in it till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Went home. The only rule was you could do whatever you wanted, but you better be back at work at 8 o'clock in the morning with a white shirt, ready, bright eyed and bushy tailed.
Oh, wow.
And that was, I had the most fun. I was just in heaven.
How old were you at this time?
I guess I was, by this time, I think I was 27.
Yeah. So this is where, because you and I talked before, I think you talked about, what was it? The Posse Comitatus and the sovereign citizens who don't think they have to pay taxes, that kind of thing. That's this part of your career?
I dealt with them more. I did regular IRS stuff, law enforcement type stuff for the first 3 years, I think. In 1981, I got sent to a one-man post of duty in Bend. And Julie and I and the kids moved to Bend. Julie was selling real estate, but she quit doing that once she got to Bend. And she kind of stayed home with the kids for 10 years. There wasn't really a lot. My immediate supervisor and I did the groundwork to open up this office in Bend, but there wasn't really the big cases that are interesting to work for IRS. There just wasn't enough money over here. And so the work I had was a lot of tax protesters. There were a lot of those guys till finally they were just making me crazy. My boss was going to assign me. The problem was they had a big mouth and they talked a big game, but most of them were unemployed. Or they just worked spottily here and there and got canned and then say, oh, he fired me because I'm a patriot. It was just bullshit. My boss, and then I'd have to work them, and I'd have to go listen to them talk and listen to all their bullshit, and then I'd finish work the case. And then they wouldn't have made enough money that the court would often just say, well, okay, time served, go away.
Oh, wow.
The courts didn't like them either. I finally told my boss, and he assigned me another one of these guys, and I said, Bob, I'll call the son of a bitch out and shoot him in the middle of the street, but I'll be goddamned if I go through another one of these waste of time cases.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not worth it. About that time, I got a chance to work undercover. Just a fluke. I happened to be going into Portland. An agent, a full-time undercover agent from Seattle, needed somebody to fill into a role. He was acting like a money launderer and he needed somebody to be the bad guy that he was laundering the money for. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. I mean, I don't care. What do I do? He gave me a quick 5 minutes on how to be an undercover agent and I stepped into the role. Well, I did everything wrong. It was kind of a thing here. But I stayed on my feet and held it together to get through the meeting. And he was impressed by that, because he said, you know, I put you in a terrible position, and he told me to act like a drug dealer from Miami, except he had kind of background on his bad guy. And as soon as I tell him that, the bad guy says, we're at a big dinner at the Benson Hotel and a bunch of people there. He said, I'm from Miami. I know all about Miami. Where are you from? Shit, I didn't know about Miami. I couldn't even spell Miami. So it was a very long dinner where I did a lot of tap dancing, but I held it. I kept my head enough to hold it together, and he held his deal together. And so he said, you know, you've got what it takes to be an undercover agent. Are you interested in that? And I said, sure. And so from then on, there wasn't a formal undercover program at the time. So I was just he was my mentor, and he started working me into deals and teaching me how to do it. And that was way more fun than I was having in Bend. But the bad part of it was that we were working all up and down the United States, all up and down the Western United States and Alaska and Hawaii. I was gone all week. I mean, I would get in late Friday night or early Saturday morning, be absolutely exhausted, grumpy, and have to go get on a plane again Sunday afternoon so that I could be someplace Monday morning. Most of these deals, we worked as though we were stationed, let's say, that we had offices in San Francisco, but we were working in Las Vegas. We had clients all around. And depending on what the deal was, I was either a narcotics trafficker or a money launderer working for narcotics traffickers. At one point, we worked to once a bunch of brothels in Nevada that weren't reporting their income. And I actually, there was a guy in Eugene who was also a special agent. He was a Marine trained pilot. He could fly fixed wings. He could fly jets, props, helicopters, whatever you wanted to fly. The Marine Corps taught him to fly it. And he was an instructor rated in all those things. So he's a great pilot. So we would lease an aircraft and fly into some of these out of the way places like Winnemucca or Elko or someplace like that, Nevada, and act like we were big hotshot money people. I was the big hotshot money guy from San Francisco. And these brothel owners were desperate to sell these places. They were dumps most of the time. They weren't making very much money, but they were running a double set of books.
So you're flying into these places in these private jets, and they're whining and dining you trying to get your business?
Not in a private jet, but in a King Air twin engine, sure. or a Cessna, sometimes just in a little Cessna, but just to look the part, just to look like we were, you know, rich, lots of money. Yeah. And then they would wind and dine, to the extent you could be wined and dined in some place like Elko or Winnemucca.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it was all sorts of funny things would happen. This pilot, Jerry Pierce, was a real straight-laced Marine Corps colonel. He was still in the Marines in the reserves. And he would fly me in. Well, they would offer me the run of the house. Now, you know, would you like to be with the girls? Or would you do that? No, I like to just keep things strictly business. But my pilot's here. And so these girls would be crawling all over him, and I just did it to be honored, to tease him. And we would get out of those things and be fine. And he'd say, God damn you, don't you ever do that to me again. Those girls, I probably got all kinds of things crawling on me.
Yeah.
He was a great guy, but very straight-laced, and he didn't like this.
So how long did you work for the IRS total? I mean, you retired from the IRS, right?
Actually, I retired. The end of that story is that Julie was looking for work, as she said. The kids were old enough to where she didn't need to be home all the time. I wanted the last grade step, which was a 13, a GS-13, to finish out my career as a special agent. And through another long story you don't need to hear, that they didn't want to, they didn't want to put a 13 in Bend. They didn't have any moving money. They wouldn't let me move back to Portland. I said, I'm going someplace. I got sent back to Washington, D.C. to teach undercover training, which by that time we were, there was formal school for undercover for special agents. And I was, while I was there teaching it, the director of operations for the national program got to know me and said, hey, I want you to come back here and work for me. And would you be interested in moving? You know, I was an Oregon boy. Moving to Washington, D.C. just sounded like, oh, my God, no, you just don't do that.
Yeah,
you don't leave Oregon, for one thing. But it worked out perfectly. Julie is brilliant, and it was no accident that she got back to the Senate and ended up, I mean, she didn't sell herself as, she had a brilliant career with the Senate. She was an exceptional person. And so it was perfect for us. She was getting offered office manager jobs and shit jobs in her field in Bend. And so we both just said, well, let's go for it. You know, we weren't big planners. We just kind of took life as it came, but we did take risks and take opportunities when they came along, which worked out great for us. So, you know, Julie, I was getting paid to drive back to Washington, D.C. On a further training mission and a house hunting trip for the move back there. She just hopped in and came with me, went back, did her interview, got the job. That was huge for us because it gave us two incomes to buy a house on rather than one, which meant we got to move a lot closer into the D.C. target area, where the commute, although it was still horrendous, was not as bad as the guys that were just living off one income, which were another hour out from the commute. So, and then she did splendidly with her job. And I did good with mine. I ended up finally transferring over to a little agency called FinCEN, the Financial Enforcement Intelligence Network, something like that. I can't even remember the acronym. But it was, I got a chance to, I had been kind of the hitman for my office in dealing with the Department of Justice over a particular informant that got arrested in England by DEA. And we said, hey, back off this guy. He's our informant. And they said, no, you don't, he's a rogue. You don't know what he's doing. And we're taking him. And I had to go to the Department of Justice and argue that the DEA was the one that was being rogue and they were out of line. They didn't understand what this guy did. And then I ended up, DOJ just threw up their hands and said, well, actually, DEA had the Department of Inland Revenue with England arrest this guy. And so DEA just said, well, we're not going to get him out for you. So I had to go to London and argue with, explain to the guys in London that this guy really, we did know what he was doing and we were using him to arrange international level undercover pickup operations where he picked up large amounts of money and laundered it so that we could find out where they were stashing the money.
Jeez.
And I won that argument, but in doing so, I made a big enemy of the Department of Justice, of one particular undersecretary of the assistant attorney general of the attorney general. So this woman did not like me at all because I forced them to, it finally came down to, I said, okay, if DEA has evidence against this guy, let's put it on this table right here. Bring it in here. If they bring it in here in a week, fine, I'll back off. I'll let this all go. But if they don't, I'm going to London and I'm getting this guy out. And I'd been given permission to do that by my agency. And I won. that when it, they said, yeah, we'll do it. And then the week came up and they didn't have the evidence. And I knew damn well they didn't have it. And
so that's embarrassing for them, right?
Pardon?
That's embarrassing for them.
Yeah, it embarrassed her.
Yeah.
And it was a high-level meeting, and she looked like she didn't have her finger on the pulse of what was going on, which she did not. Yeah. And so she set out to get me. So kind of the next thing I know, the assistant director of criminal investigation calls me in and says, Al, I don't know what, you know, I know everything that you did, and I agree with it, and you did a good service for us, but this woman is after you. And she's going to make life very difficult for us and for you. So there's a little agency over here called FinCEN. They want a liaison from IRS. And I said, well, what does that do? And he says, really nothing. It's just a glorified spot, but it'll get you out of the line of fire. And, I want you to take it. The carrot for me is it was about a 20-minute walk from my house rather than a 45 to a minute to an hour and a half commute.
Yeah.
Lizzie was in junior high school by that time, or I think she was a freshman in high school actually by that time, and was getting in trouble, which was a new experience for us. Her sister didn't do that. Lizzie was kind of the wild child.
So your older two daughters didn't get in a whole lot of trouble, and then Lizzie comes along and breaks the mold?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Lizzie was more like me. She was the wild child. She was getting in trouble. She didn't do well in school, where her older sisters did great in school. She just learned differently.
Sure.
And the school system didn't have anything set up to help her learn. I always knew once Lizzie got out and got a job, she was going to do smashingly, and she has done so. And so did her sisters. I don't mean that, but
right.
Lizzie has done a terrific job. She's got a great career going for her, but she struggled in school. So it was great that the point I'm making was that move gave me an extra 3 hours a day at home.
That's huge
when you've got a kid that's needing some backup and needing some support, rather than getting home at 7 o'clock, I was getting home at 4 o'clock if I wanted to. I mean, nobody cared what I did at FinCEN. The other neat thing about it was that, you know, after a couple of months of sitting around reading the Wall Street Journal with my feet up on the desk, I was bored to distraction. There was a DEA agent there who was in a kind of the same boat I was in. And I didn't have problems with the DEA agents. I had problems with their infrastructure and their New York office and things like that. So he and I both had different angles on the kind of case that I was working on that I got crossways with DOJ on. And we sat down, and to make a long story short, because I think I'm running on too long here, we figured out, because we had access to the undercover operations going on in DEA, he had DEA and FBI, I had IRS and Customs, and we could go talk to those agents and get them to tell us how, you know, their secret informants were getting information, how all this worked. And there was some stuff about how the Colombian cartel as a whole was laundering its money. And nobody really understood how they did it. And we used our position at FinCEN to figure that out. And the first thing you know, we had a task force working under us, and we were computerizing all this information, which was kind of a new thing. Computers were just coming on right then, and we were making databases of all the pickups. We set up a database that was handling all of the narcotics, money laundering, undercover operations that were going on in the United States. And all of these different agencies, except for the FBI, began to play ball with us. And so they could plug in when they were going to have an undercover operation going on here. Well, and we were finding out that they were working each other about half the time because nobody ever tells anybody about what's going on with their undercover operations.
Yeah, sure.
And so we saved two groups of agents coming together with guns drawn.
Yeah, right.
We stopped that kind of thing. Plus, we figured out that nobody really understood exactly what they were doing. And we figured out with the help of an informant who was highly placed in the banking community in Colombia, we figured out how the Colombian black market peso exchange worked and how they were using foreign trade between businessmen in Colombia and businessmen in the United States who had nothing whatever to do with narcotics were laundering this money for the Colombian cartels, the big guys in Colombia. We figured out how all that worked. So that was kind of the end of my career. I got to testify before Congress. I testified before the House Banking Committee. I testified before a caucus that was run by the Senate Finance Committee. And that was a great experience for me. I got to travel to Colombia. I got to travel to Panama. I got to travel to Europe in working on this thing and figuring out how it worked and then telling other people how it worked. And I learned something about foreign trade, and it was just a great way to end my career.
Wow. And it sounds like a crazy career. I mean, you were all over doing everything. That's pretty cool. That's exciting.
It was. I mean, it was great. I loved it. You just kind of take your opportunities as they come along. And
yeah, right.
I got to do a lot of interesting stuff. Julie was having a fantastic career at the same time, so it worked out well for us. She did consulting at the end of her career. I went to work for Ernst & Young for about 3 years. That was kind of a letdown. But it wasn't anything that I did wrong. It just didn't work out very well. It was a combination of Ernst & Young really wasn't the red hot company I thought it was. That's a whole different story, but and the 9/11 happened and terrorism became the big deal instead of narcotics. And so the narcotics officers within the government quit putting so much pressure on the banking community about laundering drug money and got more into putting pressure on them about laundering terrorist money. Which we also laid the groundwork for that, because in figuring out how this laundering money through international trade worked, it works the same way for the terrorists that it does for the drug traffickers. That's how you launder money big time. And so we laid the foundation that FinCEN and the FBI used to start figuring out how the terrorists were laundering money as well. And about that time, I split and went to work for Ernst & Young, but there wasn't as much work in that area with private firms helping bankers not launder money for narcotics traffickers. And so I worked for them for 3 years. I made good money. So we kind of, Julie and I both ended up making a lot more money than you normally make with a government career.
Sure.
That was nice.
Can we talk about your daughters for a second? Because now that talking to you reminds me of a couple stories that they brought up, and perhaps you can corroborate. Lizzie was telling me that, I don't know the details off the top of my head, but she got in trouble, like legal trouble, and you had to convince them to give her community service so she could go to college. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What was that? I'm trying to remember. I don't have the details off the top of my head.
It was just one of those. Lizzie wanted to go to Ocean City, which was a town in Delaware where kids went to party for their senior break or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they went over there and got arrested. It really wasn't a very big deal. The police came because they were making a hell of a lot of noise in the hotel room they were staying at, and they had booze there, so they got arrested for it. It was just a racket that the police had. They were just shaking these kids down. They would fine them and make money off. It was a way to make money off these kids. But all of Lizzie's friends told her, oh, just blow the criminal summons off. The cop won't show up for court and nothing.
Oh, wow.
And I said, Lizzie, you got arrested. If you don't show up, then they'll issue a bench warrant for your arrest. They'll come get you. And you will have a criminal record, and you won't be able to get into college.
Yeah.
She said, now my friends just say it's no big deal. You just don't understand, Dad.
And yeah, right.
It was one of these, Dad, you're just old and stodgy, and you don't get it. This isn't going to work. And I said, Liz, I am your dad, and you don't get it. You are showing up. And so she showed up and got sentenced to, I don't know, 30 days of community service, which she had to go do. And she was very put out with me because her friends didn't show up and nothing bad happened to them. But
you'll have to listen to her interview. She tells it slightly differently that you saved her, I think, and that she only got community service instead of what would have been worse. But anyway, interesting. Well,
that could have been another story too.
That's true.
There were several Lizzie stories.
Laura mentioned that she's a terrible driver and that she got several speeding tickets or whatever, and they were going to drop your insurance.
Right.
And she said, like, you had to call them and, like, talk them off the edge or off the ledge because they were going to drop your whole policy, and then you had to have, like, a coming to Jesus moment with her about not speeding.
I told her, I managed to talk the insurance company into not dropping our policy, and I absolutely promised them if this happened again, I would take her driver's license and tear it up. And I made her promise me, and she did this. I really think she did. She says she did, and I believe her. This is Laura we're talking about now, right?
Yeah.
I said, you will not go 1 mile over the speed limit for the rest of the time you're home until you go to college. Not 1 mile. And you have to swear to me that that is the way you will drive or you're done. I'll cut your license up right now.
Yeah.
And she did it.
She said she did. Yeah. She said she was very cautious because she had, several tickets. So, okay. But you had to work with the insurance company. You had to convince them not to drop you.
Yeah, I did. She had a real lead foot. I mean, she wasn't a bad kid, but she just was a careless, kind of carefree driver, and she kept getting tickets. So we had to work it out some way, and we did.
Yeah. You guys got, you and Julie got married before George, right?
Yes. We were the first ones to get married.
That was going to be my question. So you were the first of Frank's kids to get married. How early, or how much before George and Sherry did you guys get married?
Well, we got married in 69, and I think George said they got married in 71, and that squares with my recollection.
Okay, so not like crazy. Yeah, okay. You guys got married pretty young, right? Because you guys were still in college?
Yeah, that's right. Julie, I think Julie was 20, and I had just turned 21.
Wow, that is really young. Okay.
Yeah. George and Sherry had kids before we did, but I think we were married like 6 or 7 years before we had kids. But
yeah. Trying to see if I have anything else on my list. I don't think I have anything else. I think that covers the list that I wrote on this napkin here, Al.
Okay.
This was fascinating. I could do this all day. You have really good stories, sir.
Well, there, everybody has stories. They're just, I listened to George's comments and he planned a lot more than Julie and I did. We just kind of took things as they came. But that was just our personalities. We were more risk takers, and we made it work out for us.
Well, I absolutely appreciate you taking time out of your day. I definitely learned something. So, that's all I really got. Oh, I know what I'll ask you about. I forgot to, I didn't write this down. I had it in my head, though. Talk to me about the honeybees. You were into honeybees for a while, right?
Yeah, I get interested in things and like to learn about them. And I'm really kind of although my education doesn't show it, I was really more of a science guy. I had a science minor coming out of college. And I always liked science and math way more than anything else in school. And so I got a chance to join the bee club here. And it just so happened that a week or so after I joined the club, a semi truck full of bees, literally, a 40-foot flatbed trailer loaded up with six high stacks of beehives.
Wow.
Up north of Madras. And the guy that I've kind of gotten associated with the bee club, and it was also Oregon State had a master beekeeper program where you took classes from. Mm-hmm. And I was just starting that. And they said, come on. So we went up there. The Department of Transportation asked the local bee club if they could borrow a bunch of bee suits so that they could go kill these bees because they were a traffic hazard. And we said, no.
Yeah.
But we'll go get all the bees for you if you'll help us collect them. And so we did. There were all these tipped over beehives. And just this huge swarm of bees.
So we're talking about like boxed beehives, on the just tipped over on this truck.
Right, right.
Okay.
The truck drove off the road. The guy went to sleep and dumped a whole semi trailer of beehives down in the ditch next to the road north of Madras. And these bees are all swarming around there, and they can't have any traffic go through there. Even after they got the truck out of the way, because there's just this huge cloud.
Huge, yeah, right.
But the bees really weren't, I mean, they would, you got stung a little bit, but not very much. The bees were mostly just, oh my God, what's happened to our home?
Confused.
Where's our queen? Why are all these other bees that I don't recognize the smell of here?
Yeah.
And the bottom line to all this is I ended up having five hives. We brought all these hives of bees back to Bend, set them up.
At your house?
The insurance people didn't want them. They paid the guy, they paid the owner for what they were worth.
But
then technically the insurance company owned all the hives, but they didn't want them.
Right.
So we set up all these hives and just divvied them up out amongst the bee club.
And so how did you get involved? What made you say, hey, I want to join this bee club?
We had that land at Ten Peaks and I know what it was. In order to get the farm deferral, or in order to get the deferral on taxes on that land, we started out with a wildlife management program, which is a state program where you run your land a certain way for the benefit of wildlife, and they let you have a farm deferral in effect, which normally with a farm deferral, you have to be doing something that qualifies as farming. Well, we weren't doing anything that qualified as farming. We didn't want to farm that land, but we wanted the tax deferral. It was a big deal to us, especially since the house we had in Virginia did not sell. This was 2008 or 9 by this time, and the market crashed and nothing was selling. So we had this house back in Virginia we couldn't get rid of. So it was very important to have the tax deferral because we were supporting two big houses. And we got into an argument with the people running the farm deferral. And so I told them to take the deferral and stick it. Well, then I've got to figure out what to do about the taxes. So I went to the county. I said, you know, this is my problem. What do I need to do in order to keep this farm deferral? And the guy gave me a brochure, and one of the things on it was honeybees. And so I said, seriously? And how many hives do I have to run? And he said,
yeah.
You just have to have some bees on the property. You just have to be raising honeybees and sell some of the honey. And I said, how much? And he said, it doesn't really matter. We don't require you to be a good farmer. We just require you to be a farmer. And so I said, okay, fine. So that's how I got in. And it was very interesting to me.
So it was, I mean, the whole thing started off as a tax thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The more interested I got, the better I liked it. And we did end up having these hives of bees. We harvested honey from them and we sold it to the local vore store here. We sold our local honey. And they loved it. And, you know, we sold $100 or $200 worth of honey, and it qualified for our farm deferral.
Hey, that works, huh?
Pardon?
I said, yeah, whatever works, huh?
Yeah, whatever works.
But, so, and you said there's a stump in your yard now that you're talking about converting into a hive.
Yeah, I actually am working on that right now. That's my project going on outside. That I cut this tree down because it was growing too close to our garden. And it was a great big juniper tree. I mean, I'm talking probably at least 3 feet, well, not 3 feet, 2.5 feet probably across at the base. And I cut the stump off about waist high, and then the tree was hollow. So I cut a big log out of the hollow part, got my equipment out there and raised that hollow log up so it's sitting on the stump sideways. And cut all the crap out of it. It was mostly rotten in the middle, but there was lots of junk in there. So I cleaned it all out and ground it down to bare wood. And now I'm going to build a beehive in it.
Yeah, that's cool. I've always liked bees. I have a friend that was talking about putting a beehive in his backyard, and I was kind of eyeballing it. I think that'd be fun. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have to come over when I get it going again, and we'll.
Yeah, let me know. I'd love to see it. That sounds super cool.
Yeah, you should. It's fun. I bet you would really like it. It's so interesting. The hive itself behaves like a super organism. It behaves as though it's one entity, and it's kind of like Star Trek. It's the Borg.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they all the bees operate for the collective. It's really neat.
Well, I mean, they're an important part of, you know, the food ecosystem, and yeah, so. Cool, Al. Well, I should probably go check on my kid. He's been downstairs unsupervised for 2 hours. Who knows what he's taken apart? Roland's a lot like George, actually. George and I were comparing notes at the family reunion about all of my electronics that Roland has unsoldered or resoldered or taken apart, so.
Yeah, good for
well,
you.
I appreciate you taking the time. It has been very educational, and I'm sure we'll be in touch soon.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot, sir. Have a good one.
I love what you're doing, and I'll look forward to hearing more stories from the rest of the family.